We've got Deborah Lipp with us, who is a witch. That's right. An out-of-the-closet, self-proclaiming, proud-to-announce witch high priestess, no less. And we are talking about the implications of that. And it's fascinating that I've got, several hours more of questions, but not too many hours more to go, to say the least. I'll hog Deborah this hour, and then she'll be open to you next hour. But some of the fast blasts, I think, are just fascinating. For instance, when you look at it, is it possible that maybe a spell has been cast upon an entire country? Or certainly, I think we've got a couple nominations right there for that, as far as that goes, and so much more. So we'll get back to it in mere moments right here on Coast to Coast AM. It's Coast to Coast AM. I'm Raleigh James. Deborah Lipp is with us. And, you know, that was a good question, and I believe that it was from Tony, Deborah in Knoxville, who said, is it possible to put a curse on a civilization or a country or a large group of people?
People pray for large groups of people all the time, and prayer is not unlike magic. It's calling upon a spiritual force, and asking it to achieve a particular goal. And this happens all the time. Of course, there's all kinds of competing prayers out there. So how effective any one of them is questionable. The thing is that the more specific and focused your spell is, the better it works. And it's really hard to concentrate on a whole country.
Now,
it's easier to concentrate on a specific spot.
And I can see that. But with the ebb and flow of civilizations, there are times, clearly, that we might be inclined to think, gosh, we all must be cursed or something of this nature. But on a more serious sense, if you believe, whether it's personally or geographically or whatever, that somebody is casting spells that are not in your best interest, what can you do to protect yourself or undo the effects?
The easiest thing to do, like I said, a simple form of psychic shielding, which is to visualize a beautiful, beneficial shield surrounding your body. Usually people use glowing white light surrounding your entire body, and that this is impenetrable by harm. I like to, when I'm doing this, I like to visualize something nasty coming close to me and then bouncing right off because my shield is so good. This helps me to reinforce the knowledge that it will work. And then once I've done that a few times, I like to visualize something very good coming to me and getting right through my shield, because you don't want to shield out the good. It's kind of like a polarized lens. It's your spiritual sunglasses. You want to let the light in. You just want to keep the UV rays out.
So, therefore, if you feel that you've been, quote-unquote, cursed for some period of time, or whether you feel this is just happening to you immediately, by continually practicing the white light example, this hopefully will reverse the effects?
I've met an awful lot of people over the years who think that they're under a curse, and very few of them are. Mostly you're shielding just to protect yourself from ordinary negative energies. For instance, suppose you work in a psychiatric hospital. You're a psychiatric nurse. You're around people with lots of negative and painful thoughts all day. And that can get to you. It's not that they're cursing you. It's that you're in an environment in which there's a lot of negative energy. So this would be a person that might really want a shield every morning before going into work.
Now, since you said very few people that you've met have had a curse on them, this almost implies that there have been a few cases when you've been able to see that somebody did have a curse on them. How did you see that, and what were the effects?
I was contacted once by somebody who was absolutely sure that a couple had a curse on them. They actually contacted my husband at the time, it's very rare. But these people had a particular family story about having been cursed by a gypsy while on the boat coming over to Ellis Island. you know, there was a whole family history involved, and we met with these people, and we could sense that there was a dark cloud hanging over them. It was very uncomfortable. You know, you rely on your intuition, you rely on your psychic sensitivity. Two of us went so we could kind of check back and forth with each other because, you know mm-hmm. it's nice to double check with somebody. There's always the possibility that you're just wrong. Intuition isn't 100% fail-safe method, but when you're dealing with psychic phenomena, it's the best method you have. So, you know, he kind of, my ex-husband, who, you know, we were married at the time, mm-hmm. he kind of felt what he felt, and I kind of felt what I felt, and we consulted, and we were both feeling the same thing, so that was kind of affirming. And then we proceeded to go through their house and command the it's not a lot different from an exorcism. You tell the negative forces that it's time for them to leave, and you bless the home, and you know, create it as a place of goodness where a curse cannot reside, and you release negative energy and send it away. Sometimes you use a diversionary tactic. Like you can bury an egg at the border of a property, and as the egg rots, it draws all the rottenness to it.
Does that work?
If you do it with intention and focus and put your power into it, yeah, it works really nicely. And
interesting.
It's a good little trick.
Now, you mentioned your former husband, Isaac Bonewits, who I know wrote the preface of your book, which I've read. And I looked up a little information about him, and I found it was fascinating that he was the only person ever to get a degree in magic from UC Berkeley.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Bonewits, by the way. And, yeah, he was considerably better known than I was when I met him, because I hadn't written any books yet, but he was very famous for books that he'd written. And we're still great friends. He's a wonderful magician, and he's a druid, and terribly experienced, and I've learned a lot from him.
Well, I love the fact that he could embarrass the UC Berkeley faculty, because I doubt that they realized they were giving anybody a degree in magic until
they had a self-study program, but you had to get faculty approval. But he was quite a flirt, and he got everybody in the administration office, all the women in the administration office, on his side. The joy of it for him was, in addition to the fact that it started his career, that, you know, state university diplomas are all signed by the governor.
Right.
So his degree is signed by the governor of California circa 1970, and that was Ronald Reagan.
Sure, sure.
So he got a real kick out of that.
That is great. Now, the other thing I read about him was that during his time there, 66 to 70, he had joined Anton LaVey's Church of Satan, which brought up a lot of questions for me, and that is, is this really Satan worship, and what is Satan worship?
Well, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there who call themselves Satan worshipers or Satanists. Most of them don't worship Satan. Isaac was with the Church of Satan for less than a year when he was a teenager, and he likes to tell funny stories about it. He's very against it. But he was seeking something, and once he realized that there were other things he could be seeking besides Satanism, he was out of there like a shot. But you know, the people in Anton LaVey's Church of Satan, they're really worshiping their own ego and placing themselves above other concerns, and that's the most common form of Satanism. And there are some people who actually worship evil. They're very, very rare, even among people who call themselves Satanists. I've never met one. Every now and then I've read about one, and usually they're just crazy.
When we talk about yin and yang, that implies that there probably is a Satan. Do you think so?
No, if there is a Satan, then there has to be something that's all good also. And you know, we were talking about nature and how complex nature is and how full of shades of gray nature is. I don't think that anything is all good or all bad. I think there is such a thing as evil. But a force of evil running the show and pulling for evil is not something that I have any evidence for and doesn't seem plausible to me.
Are witches in general, and of course when we say witches, this is more than just Wiccan, obviously, because witchcraft goes back to the beginning of time. And I think you can get books on this that date way back and look at spells that include pulverizing newt brains and things like this. And actually, that's a pretty good thing to ask. In terms of, you look at the spells of yesteryear, and they required you to get the liver of some bird or something and do all this to make your spell come true. I assume that modern witches or Wiccans aren't out for bird livers. So are these things merely symbolic of focusing the attention, or did they have properties?
Things that witches use have properties. One of your sources of power, like I said, is spiritual forces. That's prayer, right? Another source of power is the concentration of your own mind. But you and I were discussing earlier that there's some weaknesses in the concentration of your own mind, namely that when you're raising power and you're kind of going off into, you're kind of going out of your head, and it's harder to concentrate. So you might want some other things that help you focus, that are just purely symbolic, and you might want some things that have their inherent power. You asked me earlier, do plants, for example, have spiritual essence? And plants certainly do have an essence, a quality. It's not a suggestion to say, for example, that lavender helps you sleep. Lavender helps you sleep because the chemical properties of that aroma are relaxing. Caffeine, it's not mind over matter that makes caffeine keep you alert. Caffeine keeps you alert.
Mm-hmm.
So plants definitely have their own properties, and the skillful witch will learn to harness things in nature that have properties that are useful.
Okay, so, and we all can, when it comes to health, understand all the natural things that would impinge upon health. But is there anything to harness for wealth? Is there some plant that, hey, this is the plant of money?
Yeah, there's also a lot of them. Listen, people have been concerned with a very finite number of things throughout history.
Yeah, give me a list of these money plants.
Well, keep a leaf of basil in your wallet.
Okay.
Or a sprig of rosemary is good, too.
Okay.
But a basil leaf is good in the wallet.
Okay.
You know, always give money away. You know, throw coins in charity boxes.
Right.
Whenever you see them, because whenever you're throwing money away, you're doing so on the assumption that you have enough. So you're creating this thought form.
Right, and that goes back to the thought forms. But in terms of, and that makes sense, the tangibles, so that when you're half out of your mind, you've got this tangible thing. Basil, rosemary, any gems that bring me money?
Malachite is good.
Okay.
It's green, you know.
Right.
and really, I have tons of reference books on my shelves, and when there's things that everybody knows off the top of their head. You know, sage is purifying, lavender is relaxing, rosemary is purifying, frankincense is spiritual, myrrh usually is good for bringing money. There's things that, you know, your basic witch's toolkit, but then if I was constructing a spell, I would use my reference books and not rely on my memory, particularly as I get older.
Okay, so then I've had some people say, well, spells are no different than prayer, but it sounds like what you're saying is that prayer is part of the spell, but not its entirety.
Some people do say that spells are no different from prayer, but I think that there are many sources of power, and prayer is just one of them.
Right. Now, we've also had individuals ask about spells for health. And obviously, when you're saying that you're worshiping the earth and you're aware of nature and all that, there are some holistic things that make sense health-wise. But on the other hand, health is more complicated even than diet. So in terms of casting a spell for good health, is that as much casting a spell for mental good health as physical good health?
the problem is that good health is this really vague term. Are you talking about healing a specific illness, or are you talking about just staying healthy? You know, you stay healthy by having a good spiritual relationship in whatever religion you're a member of, taking good care of your body, eating right, exercising, and, you know, getting fresh air and quit smoking.
Right, yeah, the basics. But
healthy.
When people would come to a witch for a health spell, for the most part, they got something going on there. It's usually not, gee, I want to be just in robust health. It's usually that, you know, hey, my liver's out or my knee hurts or it's my sacroiliac, something.
Right.
It causes people to focus on this.
Sure. And just like when you go to the doctor and you say, make me well, he has to know what's wrong first. I'm the
right.
same way. And I keep a copy of Grey's Anatomy in the house, and I keep a medical encyclopedia in the house, so that when somebody comes and says, you know, we need to do some healing work. And healing is one of the primary things that a witch is concerned with. We spend most of our magical energy on healing. I am going to look that up. I'm going to find out. If somebody says they've got, you know, a cyst in their liver, I want to make sure I remember exactly where the liver is. And, you know.
It's the big one.
Somebody has something wrong with them, and I'm like, really, could you write that down? Because I need to look that up. I just don't have any idea what you just said, because I don't speak Latin. So, you know, I look it up. I make sure I understand it. I look on my Grey's Anatomy. I figure out where it is on the picture, and yeah, that helps me understand what I'm doing. And so what I'm going to do is going to depend upon what the purpose is.
Well, you know, I think many people, when they have health problems, if they fall into what allopathic medicine knows how to treat, they're fine. But I would assume that most people who come to you are either in the quote-unquote incurable or in that nebulous group of people who have something, well, like ringing in the ears, tinnitus, for instance, where medical science says, yep, you got it. We don't know why. And so, you know, here you've got Grey's Anatomy, and you know where the ears are, and here you got the Merck manual, and you're saying, well, okay, they're not taking too much aspirin. What do you do for those unknowns?
Well, we did a spell recently that was really, really super effective. My son was sick for a really long time, and we didn't know why. And we went to a whole lot of different doctors. And nobody could figure out what was wrong with him. We had a couple of diagnoses, but then they were disproven. We weren't doing magic at first because we were doing the normal allopathic thing. And at first we didn't see a need to. And then we kind of got into this mindset where we felt like I had this fear that if I started doing magic that it would be like giving up on the doctors.
Right.
You know, so I wanted to stick with the mundane means first. And also, I mean, my son's a teenager, and it was up to him to say it was time to do magic. It wasn't up to me to push him into that. It is a spiritual decision. So what he did, he came to the group, and he said what he wanted was not a cure. What he wanted was a diagnosis.
Okay.
So we used herbs and other symbols related to knowledge and clarity and understanding. And we placed all of our energy into understanding and answers. And we had
one?
A very, very clear goal. That helps, remember.
Right.
We weren't just sort of shooting energy at this illness that we didn't understand and going, make it better, I guess. That's hard.
Yeah.
See, that's where you get stuck. You can't concentrate on that. So diagnosis was a really clear thing. And let me tell you what happened. I had been having a heck of a time finding a neurologist who would take my insurance. Some of these people... They make so much money that they don't even take insurance at all.
Right, I know.
Yeah, you have to actually pay them $500 just to say good morning. How are you?
Right.
I think it might be extra if they answer. It's crazy. So I was going through, I have a pretty good insurance plan and with a nice long list of pediatric neurologists that I could go to. So I started at the top of the list, and I called everyone on that list. And I couldn't get anyone to see him. And he saw one person who was listed in the insurance company as being a pediatric neurologist. After we saw him and we got the bill, we found out he wasn't a neurologist at all. It was an incorrect listing.
Oh, man. I'm going to leave you. I'm going to leave you right there. Hang on. And that's fascinating. We'll get back with Deborah Lipp. And again, if you go to Coast to Coast AM, you can check out her website or Raleigh.net. And we'll leave her son there. And yeah, this is a fascinating story of how this stuff works. The good news is he's still with us, so it must have worked. And we'll come back and hear the rest of that story right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got Deborah Lipp with us, too, and we left Deborah hanging there. And in fact, it's interesting, Drew had just emailed saying, can you ask how Wicca impacts Deborah's day-to-day life and if she has any more control over the outcome of events through the use of spells or magic? And boy, we're just gonna find out about that. Nothing more hopeless and helpless, I shouldn't say hopeless, but helpless than when your own child is ill and you don't know why. So here comes the teen saying, get me a diagnosis, and we'll find out what she chose, you know, beyond Merck's manual and stuff, to in fact get that knowledge imparted and how she found out. So we'll pick it up right there on Coast to Coast AM. It is Coast to Coast AM. I am Raleigh James. We've got Deborah Lipp, and we left her hanging there. So here you are. Your son's ill. And like I say, there's nothing more helpless than that. No diagnosis is made. You can't find a doctor. Love the story that you go to one who you think is a neurologist, get his bill, and he's not. So pick it up there.
Oh, yeah. That was a bad day. And anyway, I had called every neurologist on my insurance. You know, you go and you put in your zip code, and then you say your specialty, and they give you a list. I called every one of them, and we did this spell. We did this spell on a Saturday, and we were waiting for one more test to come back, and that test came back on Thursday afternoon. And the doctor said, look, we've ruled out everything except neurological. It has to be neurological. You've got to go to a neurologist. And they explained the problem was the only neurologist that we'd been able to see had absolutely said it was not neurological. And she'd been kind of rude, too. So she was, there's nothing wrong with him, kind of. And he said, look, you have to find a neurologist. That's what you have to do. It can't be anything else. So I went back to my office. From the doctor's office. I went back to work. I got back on the computer. I did the same search, same insurance company website, put in my zip code, put in the specialty, and a completely different list of doctors came up.
Really?
Like, I don't know where that list came from. It was amazing. I called the first number on the list. The woman said, I have an appointment this tomorrow.
Okay.
I told my boss, who'd known at that point my son had been sick for 3 months, so she was really sympathetic and wonderful. I said, I gotta go to see this doctor. I took him to that doctor. She spent about 2 hours with him, and she told him his diagnosis, and she and within, it took about a month, he one of the things that he really primarily needed was physical therapy, so she prescribed 6 weeks of physical therapy. 4 weeks in, he was pretty much better. And but she'd come from nowhere, and in less than a week, we had a brand new doctor and a diagnosis.
Okay, so
ultimately a cure.
Let me ask you, what exactly did this spell contain?
We placed him in the east. We were in a magic circle, which is, you know, the sacred space that we make when we do our ceremonies. And it was a Wiccan ceremony, so it was a religious ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
But we will get to a point in every ceremony when we'll ask, is there a need? Is there need tonight? Do you have need for spells?
Mm-hmm.
And people can bring something for themselves or for somebody else. And so we placed him in the east because the east is the direction of knowledge and wisdom and also of new things, beginnings. So we wanted and because we were working with the east is the direction of air. So because we were working with air, we used other air symbols, and we burned sage, which is also associated with air, and it's also associated with knowledge and understanding and purification, so it can kind of break down barriers. And I think we made up a chant. I don't even remember right now what it was, but it was something like, you know, we have understanding, or we whatever it was, and I think we used drumming to raise our power and sent it into him for him to then send the final spell towards knowledge. And when I say we raised it and sent it, I mean we raised it as in we created energy from our own bodies using rhythm and chant, which are extremely simple and extremely effective. And then, you know, sometimes people just concentrate and send the power with their minds. I'm one of those people who likes to point my hands. I look, you know, like a ridiculous superhero or whatever, but nobody's looking but other people who are doing the same thing. Helps me concentrate on the direction and the focus and moving the energy from my body outward. So I like to point my hands. There were a group of us, and we did that. And when you're doing something like that and you're sending it into a person who's present, you wait for them to, you know, give a nod and indicate that, yeah, that worked. And then you don't talk about it. You do not talk about it. My teacher said that talking about a spell right after you've done it is like plucking a baseball out of the air to see how fast it's going.
Okay.
You let it do its thing. And there's a period of time that you wait. Different teachers will give you a different period of time. But certainly if the spell works and you have a result, then it's okay to talk about it.
And so in that case, by the next day, you're managing to find the doctor from out of nowhere on the list, and he goes and gets the diagnosis. Did you, at that point, do a spell to make the healing go faster?
No, the healing was really going well enough. What we did was we did a spell of Thanksgiving. We did a ritual where we – I actually left that for him to do privately. I said, you need to – to give thanks. You know, when you worship and you ask for a blessing,
and you get
it's
it. Yeah.
Appropriate to worship and not ask for anything and just give back and say thank you.
Okay. Now, over the millennia, secret societies, whether they be associated with witchcraft or other things, were secret because there was a basic fear that if the arcane knowledge that they possessed got into the wrong hands, that all hell could break loose. And you kind of had to prove your worthiness before the knowledge was bestowed. With Wicca or witchcraft, are there any secrets held back until you're ready to hear them?
Yeah. But I can't tell you what they
are. Well, no, I my next question was not going to be, okay, spill your guts on national radio. No, we weren't actually going to go there. But so it is the case that part of this is you have to, like you had mentioned, well, your website and things have mentioned that you were ordained as a high priestess in 1986. So when you got to that high priestess mode, did that unlock some more doors of knowledge?
Yeah, most of the reasons that we keep secrets are not to prevent knowledge from falling into the wrong hands. I mean, you don't have to prevent the knowledge of brain surgery from falling into my hands, because I can read the text and it won't help. I will not know what I'm doing with the brain surgery.
Okay, so this is fascinating.
Yeah, usually your lack of understanding of what these secrets are stops you from trying to use them. So that's not usually the primary reason for keeping secrets. Most secrets are kept for reverence and for power.
Right. Well, yeah.
You know, when you and a friend have a secret, there's energy there, right? And when everybody knows, it's there's less energy.
Well, I always say the only time two people keep a secret is when one of them is dead.
Right. You know, so. Well, but remember when you were in school how much fun it was when you had a secret?
No, but I certainly have heard of the concept.
Right. Well, you know, it doesn't even matter what the secret is. There's energy in secrets. And like all energies, that energy can be used. And some of that energy dissipates. And some of it is that there's an intimacy. Mm-hmm. To magic. And that's not what people think of when they hear about magic, but there's something very personal and intimate and reverent about it. And I would no more give away all the secrets of what I do magically than I would give away the secrets of my marital bed.
Right. No,
it's not something you do.
I got that. But what you said that really struck home with me when you were talking about, you know, you could read about brain surgery but not know how to do it. Now, this gets into another aspect, which is, of course, when you decide that you're going to get involved with the craft, what do you have to do physically or psychologically or in practice to be able to get to that level where this stuff will actually work?
Well, there's lots of again, I say you've got to meditate. You've got to practice. You've got to work on your self-awareness. Knowledge of yourself is essential. Because when you're working with the inside of your own mind, you'd better darn well be able to tell when you're fooling yourself. You do psychic exercises to improve your intuition and you do meditative exercises to improve your concentration. There's all the study you do to know which herbs are which and what the proper phases of the moon for various activities are. And there's the spiritual work you do, asking the gods if you're on the right path and really listening to what their answer might be. This is all part of it. I did most of my training in apprenticeship, you know, good old-fashioned apprenticeship, working with an experienced teacher with whose knowledge and wisdom I respect who I was trusted enough that I could be in that kind of a relationship with her and not worry that she was some kind of crazy guru tripper.
When it comes to developing this type of a skill, many things that are not mystical in nature, some people have more proclivities. Some people are better painters or better writers or you know, more into math. They have certain inborn gifts that when they start to develop them, well, they're just better at it. Is the same thing true for the skills that come into play in witchcraft?
Oh, sure. But just as almost no one is completely incapable of painting, everybody can learn some of it. I mean, you know, I'm not Picasso, but I can draw a nice stick figure. You know, everybody has some capabilities. And, of course, yes, there's people who are more gifted than others. And one of the reasons that witches have covens, that we work in groups, is to supplement one another's skills.
What is the relationship between witchcraft and psychic ability?
We acknowledge the existence of psychic ability, and it is part of our skill set. Essentially, lots and lots of religions over the millennia have acknowledged that human beings have certain gifts and certain abilities, and that was just normal. At a certain point in modern history, that those skills became frowned upon by certain religions. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the Old Testament in Judaism that necromancy is forbidden, that sorcery is forbidden,
right,
that soothsaying is forbidden, and all of these things were forbidden. And this was then carried on by the church and people who practiced even healing arts were found to be in violation of church law and were found to be heretics. So skills that everybody of all kinds of religion used to acknowledge got banned. I am a member of a religion that doesn't ban those things and, in fact, celebrates those things as part of achieving human potential.
Are witches psychic by definition? I mean, is that part and parcel of it?
You know, making the effort to use the, like I said, stick with that word, human potential, but I mean, I think everybody is psychic. I think everybody, to a greater or lesser degree, has psychic skills. It's just a form of perception. And you very rarely meet people who are truly headblind. You know, some people are more gifted than others, but we use those skills. So are witches psychic by definition? Well, everybody's psychic by definition, but some people, we try harder.
One of the things that I had read on your website is that you're quite accomplished at tarot cards. And I think most of us have, you know, seen the Rider-Waite deck and all this and have looked at the pictures and here comes the tower and, oh, this is really terrible. But having the cards mean more than what these pictures are, that's where the art comes in. And so my question on that, since obviously I assume you didn't grow up as a child reading tarot cards, how much of that is a psychic gift versus training? And if it's training, how do you tune into the cards telling you more than what the picture looks like?
That's a really hard question because, again, this is something I actually teach a 10-week class on tarot, or I used to. I haven't done it in a while, but I could pull out my own notes. There are different methods by which people divine. We don't call it fortune telling, we call it divination.
Right.
And I took to tarot really quickly. The first time I picked up a deck of tarot cards, I was like, oh, this feels right. This feels natural. Whereas some people pick up tarot cards and they're always like, oh, this, I don't like these. I can't read these. I like them in part because I grew up playing cards a lot. My family is a big card family. We were always sitting around a table playing a game of hearts or something. Mm-hmm. So cards feel natural and good in my hands. I like them because they're visual, and I think that it's almost like art interpretation sometimes. You do have to study the cards. You have to study what the meanings are and what the various symbols are. And there's so many different decks available on the market that if you like some kinds of symbols better than others, then you can find a deck that works best for you. But what you're doing is you're using the symbols in the cards to help you find the path to your psychic abilities. You know, you've got this brain. We've all got this brain that is telling us all this. It's being so rational that it's preventing us from being intuitive. And I think most people have had that overthinking experience where they can no longer tell what the right thing to do is because they're thinking.
Right, rational and also fear-filled. Fear is a big component in most people's rational minds.
And inhibited. It's very, very ill-mannered to read people's minds. It's one of the reasons that many people aren't good at it.
I would if I could.
Oh, it's, you know, the people when they were two or three, you know, went to mommy and said, you know, da-da-da-da-da, true thing about the neighbor, and got their hand slapped for telling lies or for being rude. And so very, very young, we learn not to be psychic. You have to kind of unlearn that training. Well, one thing you can do with an overactive rational mind is give it pictures to look at, give it symbols to remember and think about. So while it's all engaged and busy, your psychic self can emerge.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned earlier you had a cat, and of course, what would a witch be without a black cat? I don't even know if yours is black, but
mine is orange. He's so cute.
Okay, orange. That's perfect for Halloween. Orange. So where did that connection come? Cats and witches.
You know, I really don't know. There's a manual of for witch finders that from the Inquisition, where there's all of these names of witches' familiars. That's where Piwacket comes from, and Piwacket was the cat that belonged to the witch in the movie Bell Book and Candle. Kim Novak's cat was Piwacket. It's from that Witchfinder manual. But it wasn't just cats. It was all of these creatures. I don't know why we all have cats. I had a student come to me for training, and she couldn't stand being in my house because her allergies were so bad. And I could not find another group to send her to. Everybody I know has cats. I don't know why.
Why not dogs? You know, and are dogs excluded from this? Are some of these covens half dogs and half cats, or is it a real all feline thing?
No, there's lots of dogs around too. I'm not much of a dog person myself, but one of my best friends has dogs and cats, and a very dear friend of mine who passed away 2 years ago had parrots.
Okay,
you know, the relationship with with the witch's familiar, and not all of our pets are familiars, but I think part of it is just having that wonderful psychic relationship with somebody right. who doesn't have a rational mind.
I love it. Deborah Lipp is our guest. The Study of Witchcraft is the current book, and your questions are coming up next hour right here with me, Raleigh James, on Coast to Coast AM.